So I think we're going to do it without mic, unless it's up to the ones in the back. Can you hear me? Or do you prefer to do it with mic? Well, thank you very much for coming. I'm not actually the chairperson, but I'd like to introduce the four of us, because really, I just quickly want to tell you why we're sitting here. So tonight is The Madness of Medea, Our Women Who Killed Their Children Mad. I'm Maike Ziervogel. I run Pyrene Press, and I published Beside the Sea by Veronique Olney, which was translated into English by Adriana Hunter. I'm also the author of Magda, a novel which blends fact and fiction to draw a psychological portrait of Magda Goebbels, the Nazi propaganda minister's Joseph Goebbels' wife, who killed her six children at the end of the war. I'd like to introduce Amber Jacobs. Amber works in the Department of Psychosocial Studies at Birkbeck, and she wrote a brilliant book, which I really urge everyone, there are two books I urge everyone, actually four, this one, on matricide. The Myth, Psychoanalysis, and the Law of the Mother. And basically, Amber is here to talk about the Medea myth, and eventually I would also like to introduce her book into this discussion, which is on the Metis myth, so the other side of the same coin, killing the mother, not killing the children. Then I'd like to introduce and welcome Estella Weldon. Estella is a clinical psychotherapist and the author of the other book you ought to buy, Mother Madonna Hall, The Idealization and Denigration of Motherhood. Now, I read that book after publishing Beside the Sea. When initially I published Beside the Sea, and I thought the world, you know, will embrace it with open arms, and not much happened. And somebody said, you need to talk to Estella, you need to meet her, you need to read her book, and she is a woman who will understand Beside the Sea, and she has. And then the other fantastic woman I have come across since I published Beside the Sea is Lisa Dwen. Lisa is an actress, and at the moment she has a fantastic three-piece woman Beckett play at the Royal Court, which has just been transferred to the West End, to the Duchess Theatre. And I really urge you to go and see it. There are three female monologues by Beckett, and they really send a chill down your spine. Now, I have come across Lisa because another friend of mine said, Beside the Sea ought to be a one-woman play, and you need to contact Lisa, who would be the ideal person. Lisa then converted the book into a female monologue and performed it to huge critical acclaim at the South Bank Centre in 2012. And she will, because she's at the moment so into Beckett, of course, we can't ask her to perform this whole play, but she has kindly agreed to read from the beginning of Beside the Sea. So ladies and gentlemen, please welcome. And perhaps, actually, I should also say, so what we are going to do is, Amber brings in the academic side, Estella brings in the clinical side, and really Lisa and I, in the discussion, will talk about the emotional side and how we have accessed that subject about the mother killing her children while neither of us has killed any children, how we emotionally access that subject. So, ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Lisa.
I'm going to let the audience, the latecomers, in first.
Okay, just quickly for the latecomers, because we had a number of latecomers. Lisa Dwen will now read from the beginning of Beside the Sea. Lisa performed Beside the Sea as a one-woman play at the South Bank Centre 2 years ago, and in fact it was her who adapted it into a one-woman show.
Thank you very much, Lisa. That was If you can see, it's very hard, difficult, painful to listen to these voices, to listen to this voice of a woman who is in despair because nobody wants to hear. Nobody wants to hear that predicament about 2 and 6 against your children because they are in despair and isolation, complete isolation. And it took me a long time. I was working at the Portman Clinic dealing with perversion criminality. And as opposed to any other outpatient clinic, most patients were men, not women. But just listen to all these men committing all different crimes, being extremely violent, and listening to their histories about when they were children. And then some men began to really wait supposed to do that they were also having been victims of maternal abuse, that the mothers have been extremely abusive towards them, physically, verbally, and even sexually too. And of course, a problem about my quest began to be, I have to give these women not only voice, but they want to give these women a hearing. Because nobody wants to listen to these voices, nobody. Not even the most absolutely violent man sitting next to them in a group therapy session. We want to listen to a woman saying, I feel like killing my children. Oh, silly, you could never do that. You die. Nobody wants to listen. So, these women, they live in complete isolation. And, of course, you see, we always tend to identify with the victim, never with the aggressor. So the idea was then to give these women a sort of, to look at them as 3 generations before them. So these women, they were also the victims, the children of other women, mothers, they were from their mothers, etc., etc. So then, in a way, it was a way to deal with a sort of trying to get some clinical, you know, awareness and not to be judgmental. That's a problem. We try always, this is very judgmental voice, that either they are demons, evil, terrible. And, but never really to see, I mean, why is, I don't know why it's so difficult to see a woman who has been battered or whatever by her alcoholic husband and then leaves the place because she has got a public dominion and the woman is being left at home and the only thing she has there is the children who are much defenseless and then weaker. And then she identifies with the aggressor, that's exactly the same. So I don't know why it's so difficult to see the women doing these things. Because we have idealized motherhood for a long time. So in a way we're not giving the women the voice that they are having and the feeling they are having many times. And by then we're not giving them any help. It's not that we're blaming women, no. Just trying to listen to them and to understand the predicaments they are going through in their lives. And with this, I just wrote this book that was published in 1988, so there's the original version, in which all sort of women, which are that sort of, it's a horror story in a way, but they are all true. I'm always saying, I'm the messenger of bad news, because then I began to see also the malignant bonding, and was about couple doing things against their children. All is coming, in a way, more resources are being created. In a way, the fact that the book is still in print, has never been out of print, it worries me too. Because in a way it means that there is still news. It's still not accepted. There's still sort of situation going on there. And in this book, by chance, I had sort of about Medea that I think perhaps you talk about the myth and Medea. I'm sure that some of you must be very aware about this. But it's very much the killing of the children is done to take the revenge of her husband, to hurt him in a way that he can really feel really the pain. And you can see a lot about this nowadays. With divorce cases, you are now more and more aware that a lot of these situations are taking place with women doing things against their husband by doing things to the children, and vice versa too. But I think now you better you do it your...
Yeah, do you want to just read that little extract? Because because I think that's okay. Quite good.
Another instance of literature is Medea, who exemplifies not only the power of motherhood, but also how the biological clock determines a woman's actions. Medea is highly intelligent, in power, loved, and in love. When abruptly and unexpectedly dispossessed of all this, she becomes aware of the only power left to her, her children, who become the targets for her revenge against their father, Jason. When he decides to abandon her, Medea, for a much younger and a much more powerful bride, Medea skillfully and subtly hatches a plan designed to give as much pain as possible to Jason, to kill their children. She feels justified in her actions, such as her agony at her own predicament, and manages to complete the terrible deed within the space of 24 hours.
I'm coming at the myth. I'm interested in the way in which myths get transmitted and which versions of myths that we as a contemporary culture are engaging with. So Medea is an ancient Greek myth that is told in many variations by many different writers. A myth which is by definition an unstable corpus of interweaving stories. So Medea is not just one thing. She represents a cluster of stories related to this myth. And what interests me is what survives intact over the centuries, and why as a culture we're interested in particular versions of the Medea myth, or even more crucially, how we only know one version of the myth because of the way the myth has been transmitted down through the centuries. So my interest as a scholar of the way in which myths are recycled and handed down, and as a feminist scholar, I'm interested in which bits of the myth we as a culture prioritise. So all of you probably know Medea as the kind of, the through her act, through her killing of her children, and that's probably the main thing, as a revengeful, psychotic wife that killed in revenge. And that's where Euripides starts his play, which is probably where we are getting our information via Euripides, who wrote the tragedy of Medea out of all the plethora of stories available to him through earlier Greek writers. So, just to say that the myth of Medea has many other angles which I want to talk briefly about, because what I'm interested in is how we might, as a culture, collaborate with what Estella brilliantly theorised in her book, which is either the idealisation of motherhood, or, in this case, its denigration and its demonisation of a very, of a fantasy structure that fascinates us, which is this devouring, monstrous maternal, which Greek myth is full of. So Medea comes in a cluster of female mythical figures, like Clytemnestra, like Demeter, like Medusa, femme fatale type figures, where femininity and the maternal are kind of transgressed and subverted and made monstrous. Euripides wrote the tragedy about Medea, which is actually quite sympathetic. He, like her, was in exile for most of his life and identified with the aggressor, which I think we do when we read that play. So he was, I reread the play today and was struck about how much of Euripides wants to sympathise with Medea. And he does this through making us remember that she's an outsider. Medea was married to Jason when they were outside of Greece, and she helped him in the battle to get the Golden Fleece, saved his life a few times, but is constantly called the foreigner, the outsider, the savage, coming from a barbaric land associated with witchcraft, sorcery. She's basically subject to a whole host of quite what we would call now racist fantasies that other her. The Euripides play is also interested in her other level of othering, so it's a mouthful, which is her status as a woman. So various times in the play she'll say, wretched are we on the earth who are born woman. But doubly wretched am I, Medea, because I'm not only born a woman, but I'm a foreigner and an outsider. So she's structurally placed as oppressed on a double level. Euripides wants us to understand the context of her act. And in a sense, I'm interested that that gets lost. And in the popular cultural imaginary, Medea stands up there as this monstrous figure who then links your ideas in culture and psychoanalysis, which can, if we're not careful, reproduce ideas of a monstrous mother rather than opening it up to see the crucial dark aspects of motherhood, which are crucial to look at just so long as we don't reproduce a fantasy that demonises the mother. So that's in a sense my thing of opening up the myth and looking at its various versions to show the context of the act of infanticide is always a social one for Euripides and I think for us today. So that's where I'm coming from, if that's clear.
Well, I'd like to actually pick you up on that, Sergio, and actually lead on to, so if it's a pure social thing,
let me just elaborate on my
thoughts on this. So, yeah. I remember when I first read Beside the Sea, if I had been, there was one particular line, and in fact Lisa takes them out in her play, there are a couple of lines, but one particular one, which I would have loved to take out, which is where in the play, how many of you have read Beside the Sea? Okay, just so as you could hear from Lisa's, it's a monologue, and it's about a woman who takes her two sons to the seaside. And in some ways, I think we know from the first page where this is going to end. She ends up killing them both at the end of the book. Now, there's one line in that we don't learn, and this is, I think, a work of genius from the side of the author. We never learn anything about really much about the past history. Of this woman. And however, we do learn that she has problems with her teeth, and that line really jarred with me. And that she also takes some pills, I think. And you take that out in your play. And I think that's brilliant, because those couple of lines jarred in the sense that I, when I read this, Beside the Sea initially, I was actually quite ecstatic by the time I finished the book. Because there was finally an author who had spilled out the dark side of motherhood. And I've never read this book as a I almost read it like a myth, not as a talking about the real woman, explaining why this woman last week killed her son. Because what I think is that we all have it within us. Women and mothers, we all have the dark side within us, and we have the dark side as daughters within us, and I want to come to that in a moment. That's also what I think Lisa will slightly talk about. And by putting it purely in a social context, or highlighting the social context, for example, of Medea, I think there is a risk of saying, well, it's only foreigners who do that, or it's only women who have, you know, rotten teeth who do that. I don't think so. I think we need to accept, and I'm not saying that we're all capable of killing our children or even have the intention of killing our children, but we need to, as society and as women, I think, accept our dark side, that we have a very, very violent, very dark side. And if we don't acknowledge that, we basically psychologically do things to our children which we don't want to necessarily do. And I think, Lisa, your intro into Beside the Sea was from a daughter's point of view, wasn't it?
Well, it was one of the things that gripped me, but I suppose when I first read it, I mean, we're all familiar with Medea as one of the kind of ultimate female roles, and I suppose the shrill beginning of that and the well-worn stereotypes, I think what really fascinated me about Beside the Sea is that this is not an act of regression or of aggression or revenge, and it's nothing got to do with any man, it's not directed in any way. In this woman's warped mind, it's a rational response to the most the ugly side of life, and it's an extension of love, it's an act of altruism. She is protecting her children from the inevitable pain that will come to them. and she's someone who has fallen through the social cracks, who is struggling, not because of class, and I've changed what Veronique Olmey had kind of cast her as. It's someone who's destitute and poor. I play her kind of modern day, and just someone who's just slipped through these cracks, which can happen to any of us. And I suppose that's the thing that really gripped me. From a personal point of view, I was the kid on the school gates whose parents couldn't come and, you know, slipped through the cracks and didn't get the right kind of care because of class. So I suppose I'm always kind of intrigued in these type of roles that play against stereotype. And that's why I was so keen when I heard it to put it on as a play.
It has to remind me of a patient of mine. In a way, I just tried to write a paper. I could never write a paper because it would be too easily identified, so I just think it's better to keep it confidential. But it was somebody who, she tried to be a good mother. That's why she tried to kill her children. That's it. She said three times she tried to kill her children. Three times because, well, I must say that she was herself a product of a rape and quite a different... about Nazi and not Nazi, the whole situation was very difficult. And when she was 14, the household was filled up with women, no man there. And she was told from the beginning, you little shit, you little Nazi shit, she was absolutely all the time being. And she just was brutally raped by her man who was with the mother, and she was pregnant without knowing what it's all about. Then that baby was killed as soon as it was born, was killed by the father. Then she married somebody, an Englishman, and she had three children, and the children, actually, amazingly enough, were fine, except that she tried to kill them because she just felt that they would have exactly the same fate she had. And so, three times she tried to poison them. It's an amazing situation. She was in therapy for a long time, and then she became a grandmother, and the whole situation changed again. And she saw me very much as a mother situation. But
here we're back. I mean, with that example, we're back to the madness idea, and to have a woman who, in her past has experienced unbelievable violations of herself. And I come thinking about the myth. I mean, the myth wouldn't exist if it weren't an aspect of our human psychology.
No, I think that too. But I think there's a difference between uncovering and representing what you call the dark side of motherhood, which we all have, so feelings of aggression and rage towards our children.
But we have a sense of power.
And our power and our powerlessness.
Powerlessness
as well in relation to being one, because it's both. It's so ambivalent in that way. But there's a line between being able to have the fantasy and explore that and then acting out the actual thing. So what I'm trying to say is that when we have myths of mother murderers, then it's important to contextualize that act. Not to say that the psychic kind of mapping or terrain of the violent feelings, they should be not pathologized in a sense and made normal so that we can all talk about them with no judgment. But figures like Medea get blown up into big fantasy structures that our culture constantly circulates, which is this monstrous mother figure that the femme fatale, the monstrous mother in horror films. It doesn't help women or mothers or anything. It's a form of misogyny that collaborates with Estella's idea of mother, Madonna, whore, or the binary.
But does clinical terminology not do the same? Does it not? Do we not use those labels to expel these people from our midst as our peers, as our equals, and expel them from society? and demonized.
Yeah, exactly.
The reason why we had a journey on this play was the first director wanted me to play mad.
Yeah.
And I did. It was her job, and I did. It was my job, and I did it. And then I took back the project.
Mm. Yeah.
And I played her straight, and I played her normal, and that these lines are so thin, we're all on the scale, and they're an arm's reach away. And I suppose that's what I try and explore with a lot of projects, but this one in particular.
Yeah, that's is what's so powerful about it, to take the madness away, and the big stereotype. But you do put it in a social context. I mean, the author does, but you took out those bits. But you were saying about people that are alienated, that fall through the social class, all of those issues which form a context where we would act out rather than not. So you want it to be a universal thing that's generative for women, these texts, because they give women a structure to think about their dark side. And I do see that, and that is crucial. But equally, can you see if there's a simultaneous danger of universalizing myths like Medea myths, taking bits of the Medea myth mm-hmm. out of context, so that we then collaborate with the monstrous mother cluster of fantasies, which is a misogynist construct and therefore works against us. So it's a double-edged thing.
Yeah. I mean, what is interesting is, of course, so when I published Beside the Sea, and it was the first book Pyrene published, the first book my publishing house published, and I was slightly, in retrospect, of course, totally naive. I read this book, I thought, wow, I need to publish it. And I put it out there, and yes, and I thought the word understands. I even say in an introduction, this is the best book about mother-child relationship I have ever read, or the best novel. And so initially the reception was very slow. Now, it has become one of our bestsellers. However, why has it become one of our bestsellers? It's because those lines. People say, oh, that's why I understand now why these women kill their children. It's the social context. And so what happens is that the women who actually have the capacity, or the people like us, you know, who have the capacity of actually looking at these sort of things.
It gives them a safe prism.
Yeah.
To look at themselves without realising.
That's what I would like to think of a good literary text like Beside the Sea. But what is actually happening is, and that's why the book sells, is because yet again people look at it from a voyeuristic point of view and think, oh, it's about a mad woman who kills her children. It's by one of those.
The thing is, if Winnicott's idea, for example, of the good enough mother. I'm interested in the good enough mother for the mother. Mm-hmm. So what's happening with our culture is that there's a kind of crumbling welfare state and a crumbling and a symbolic order which is masculine, basically, and objectifies the woman and does all sorts of destructive things to the role of the mother in culture. So what I'm trying to say is, rather than, I agree, I can see what you're saying, but the danger is to not see that we have to transform our culture to make a better situation for women to mother and to be able to work through their fantasies rather than act them out. So texts like this can be an instrument of political change mm-hmm. that helps us think, yeah, we actually have to create a society where mothers can mother and where class and falling through the cracks and all of those things don't prevent that situation. So whilst there needs to be a structure, yeah, for people to not feel judged by their psychic feelings of rage towards their children, there also has to be a responsibility that the social takes and the political takes on for supporting, making a symbolic and a culture where the maternal isn't denigrated.
The most important task and the most difficult task in life is to become a parent. And that's a task that nobody's training anybody. So now it's a new movement going on that, you know, we have to train children. This is their children to become parents. So in a way, it's also the sense of empathy. So it's exactly the opposite, let's say, of the blaming of separating. We have to accept that this exists in us all and that, you know, we have to see how, by talking about this, it just helps enormously. Because the problem is when you have to keep quiet about this. So more resources are available now to women that, you know, they were, Okay, you talk about pathologizing, and in a way I just feel like, yes, in a way, we have to do some clinical term, because otherwise it's very difficult to... It's very difficult, for example, perversion. It's a very difficult term to accept, the term perversion. And in men, it's so clearly always against the outside, and always, you know, something that goes from the very sort of benign, let's say, exhibitionist, you know, exhibitionistic behavior, to whatever is going on. It's always outside. In women, they go against themselves. So if we can see women, they do damage against themselves. So like the overeating or the not eating or the cutting, the sort of all sorts of things they do against themselves. Then the problem being is that then they start being like, the children are like, I feel like objects of their own creation. So the fact is that when they are doing to their children the damage, they are doing it to themselves. They suffer enormously. They do it despite themselves, that this damage. And so they suffer enormously by doing that. And I just, all the time hear this phrase, if I could only turn the clock back. Mm. I never heard that from a man. I mean, it's women who have this enormous sense of agony about this. And she immediately, is immediately taken over herself about the sense of pain, and for the person who's dealing with them, it's very painful too. And we have to be able not to judge anymore. You know, the people are lovely to as you say, the sort of voyeuristic situation of reading. But if someone is asking to understand this behavior, that is difficult. That is a difficult thing.
Be great to hear about your book and
Yes, in some ways what I did was Magda is so first of all I have to say I have to pay my tribute to the Bonnie. I've learned a lot from her book. But I also was aware that I wanted to almost start where she left off, where she left it. So in Beside the Sea we follow this nameless woman, the narrator, until she kills her children. And that's the last thing. And we're inside her head, this woman's head, all the way through until I would argue the very last line, which, I mean, for that alone, I do hope that you will perform this again, because that scream, and then I screamed. That's the very last line, which Lisa has an inverted scream on stage. Now that, for me, is the only line where we suddenly get a glimpse from another angle. Otherwise, in that whole text, we're inside that woman's head, and we follow her. Now, what I wanted to do, what I was interested in was, when I looked at Magda Goebbels, was I wanted to look at, because in some ways my starting point was a very personal one. I struggled with motherhood the first 2 years when I gave birth to my daughter, the first child, who's now 19, but she survived. What interested me is the position being a mother and being a daughter. And what sort of mother must a mother have who ends up killing her children? So that was basically my starting point. And I also, so in Magda, for example, I have Magda's mother's voice, I have Magda as a child, I have Magda as a grown-up woman, and I have her 14-year-old daughter, Helga, who she ends up killing. And I also wanted, the reason why Magda Goebbels attracted me was because I wanted to have a woman who is very intelligent, very well educated, very ambitious. So very, making in my mind at least, the very clear cut. I'm not going to give myself as a writer the hook or the way out. To suddenly think, and she was raped, you know, and that's why all this happened to her, and that's why she killed her children. I wanted a character or a person or a voice which didn't give me this leeway. Which, you know, in some ways I could, you know, almost think this could be me, given certain situations. And how would I get there? Knowing, and this is why I also chose a real character, again, I had no way out. If I want to write this book, I have to get her to kill her children. I can't just suddenly say, think to myself as an author, well, I can't go down that route emotionally, so I will cut it.
Well, the problem for me with that, I mean, can I come in on
that?
I've been dying to talk to you about this, but there's a paradox there for me, because the social situation of Magda Goebbels is so extreme, and so it kind of takes over, that in some senses, that is why she kills her children, because the Nazis are... they have lost the war,
and she doesn't.
So there's a very, very real, big, massive, massive context, social, political context, and hope that she kills her children because of a very complex.
She denies that they have lost the war too.
Yeah,
to the children,
but
yeah.
For me, when I read your book, I was so intrigued by how to cope with, as a reader, the two aspects of the book. The one about the mother-daughter and the mother, all the stuff that we're talking about here, which isn't linked to particularity or specificity. But then, the extreme specificity of Magda Goebbels, I found, as a reader, I felt like I got to a kind of emotional impasse about not knowing how to work myself with the social context. And so in some senses, you have completely got one, it's just not class, it's something else.
Well, so what I have, and what I'm very conscious of, is of course the patriarchal structure to the extreme. I mean, Nazis, one thing they did really well is the patriarchal structure. So that's one aspect I have. However, now one thing I always say is that she was the only leading Nazi woman who did this. There were, most Nazi leading Nazi women, the men either, were prosecuted or they... killed themselves, or some of the men, in fact, killed their wives and their children.
Why the Nazis altogether? Why did he choose to take the tale in such an extreme situation, which most women aren't in? So, if you see what I mean, it's very particular. So, I'm intrigued to know how, on the one hand, you have a problem with social context, and on the other hand, you take the most massive one for the context of your book. And that's not criticism.
I'm intrigued by
that ambivalence that the text brings out. And I'd love to know, why did you set it in the...
Because I'm German.
Right.
I didn't necessarily... I mean, I always say Magda came to me. So I did not set out and thought, I need to talk about Magda Goebbels. She sort of came to me, and I suddenly realized, my God, this is the book I have to write. I have to get out of my system. And on top of it, it was the best story I could find in order to express this idea of the generation aspect. Mm. I mean, Lisa already, hinted at that. And also, I mean, and now I like to actually come to your book on matricide. Because what Amber does in her book, so she takes the metasmith. Let me just put this quickly into context. So as we know, Athena, the goddess of war, is the goddess, the motherless goddess. She was born by Zeus, out of Zeus's head. Zeus brought her forth, fully armored from his head. And in our popular understanding, she's known as a motherless goddess. Now what's of course interesting is she isn't motherless. She has Metis. Metis is her mother. Metis was a titaness of knowledge and wisdom. Zeus pursued her. She denied him. Eventually he raped her and she fell pregnant. Zeus swallowed Metis, because he was worried that the offspring would, take over from him, disempower him. And inside, she lived there, and I think even in the myth it said, it goes on for months, isn't it? Or disguised.
Yeah, and then Athena's born out of Zeus's head, and then we never hear Metis again.
Yeah.
She gets absorbed into the line of Zeus's stuff.
And even Freud never mentioned Metis.
Yeah.
And then, so what Amber then does, so that's the starting point. She then goes on to, takes the Oresteia and looks at the Oresteium. So, as we know, Orestes, kills his mother. And he kills Clytemnestra because she has killed his father, Agamemnon, who, in turn, had killed Iphigenia, their daughter, in order to get good winds to travel to Troy. Orestes is put in front of the court of Athena. Athena, and I can't remember who's, anyway, 50-50, it's, you know, for him, 50 say he's not guilty, 50 say he's guilty. Athena has the casting vote, and this is a fantastic, thank God, I mean, why can we not, as a culture or as a society? So she then says, where's that quote?
Thank you, it's something like, I cast my lot with you, no mother gave me birth, or never in the darkness of the womb was I.
Yeah, then I think the other one. Yeah. Orestes, right. I will cast my lot for you.
That's right.
No mother gave me birth. What is absolutely brilliant, because, so that's, I'm the starting point, and basically she then says, let me just try to find my, it's a brilliant book, but, I heard. So she then, so basically, Athena condemns Orestes' matricide by denying the matricide of her own mother. She denies the fact that her mother, she denies the fact that her mother ever was killed or died. And there are, of course, two problems with that, I think. If a woman denies death of her mother, so she never learns to deal with loss. And you describe that beautifully as well. So it's a... It's a limbo state. It's not dead. It's not dead enough. Is she dead? You know, basically, we don't need to look at that. It's denied.
She's kind of incorporated rather than lost.
Mm. Yes, exactly. Yeah. And then, of course, you also have that... So what is Athena's verdict basically based on is, of course, the idea of... she's, with that, giving her approval or acknowledging the fantasy of the male... men's word that they can give birth on their own without anything, and that's of course to do with omnipotence. And this is where I think it's so fascinating, is because mothers who kill their children, that's an omnipotent, you know, that there's something very, very omnipotent about this, not to accept that the reality outside works differently. It's almost like wanting to say, well, I give birth.
It's quite.
And I can take it, and it's all mine, and I can do with it what I want. And that, I find, that was another thing with somebody like Magda Goebbels in some ways. I mean, it doesn't totally explain, but it's an interesting question. Why did I get hooked on Magda Goebbels? It just allowed me to explore that.
Because for the reader, it can be the thing which prevents one getting into the kind of nitty gritty of the feelings of wanting to kill your child, because she's such a figure. Do you see what I mean? The history gets in the way.
You want to kill the children to avoid their
pain. I think it's really quite interesting that, despite yourself, I mean, you set out, you were fascinated by what Orme started, and you talk about her two crimes that kind of separate this woman from us, i.e. her social class and whatnot, with the teeth and the fact that she's already deemed mentally unwell to be on medication, that you set out to create something kind of more persuasive, more real, more immediate, and yet you despite yourself, hanker after a structure that does demonize her in some way, that does invoke blame, be it patriarchal.
Well, all that locates it clearly in the political.
She doesn't want the children to. She wants to avoid the pain to the children about the loss also of the war.
Yeah, which Medea wants as well. Medea says, "If I don't kill my sons, then my enemies will." And then there's a lovely quote which links to what you said in the Medea play. They must die, her children, in any case. And since they must, then I, who gave them birth, will kill them.
So that's the interesting
thing. The omnipotence.
Yes, you take the omnipotence, but that's exactly what I questioned with Miss Magda. I've got a scene in my book called The Vision of Magda, where she envisaged what might happen to her and her children at the end of the war. No, that's not the one I'm going to read. At the end of the war. And when I set out with this chapter, I still had no idea why she killed her children. Because again, I didn't want to give myself the option to think Veronique or me managed. So I allow myself to just skip that. Anyway, so there's Magda living in a red hole with her six children. You know, Goebbels is dead, end of war, end of... And the little, her son, comes to bed with her in the middle of the night. She's sleeping in the only bed. She's dying. And he snuggles up, and he says to her, you know, this is so much nicer than before, meaning during the war, because we weren't ever allowed to either come to bed with you, or you were sick, or you were busy. So for him, and I sat, and when I wrote that, I suddenly thought, that's it, I've got it. That's why she killed her children, because why did she kill her children? If she had had that vision, and because after, ultimately, of course, it's mine, and if she had that vision and had been able to see what that vision is telling her, she would have understood that her children's reality is a very different one. And that for her, for her son, although they were, you know, whatever, living in total poverty, surrounded by enemies, whatever, he didn't mind that because he had his mother.
I think that perhaps we have to give a space to people here. It's a lot of, it's very difficult to listen to very painful material, and I'm sure that you would like to ask some questions or to, you know, a bit of relief to all this pain. So, is anybody has got any questions?
Or has any jokes?
I saw the human play, and I saw the play, and I have to say that I did leave feeling quite a lot of empathy for her, because I think there are bits where she's saying things like, "Taught to go and see the sea." They played in the sea, as I recall. And I was so struck by how it affected my way of thinking about it. And then 2 weeks ago, I read an article in The Guardian of her. She was a single parent. It's quite a short article, and she wrote about being a mother. And I thought that was so fascinating because she put both sides, you know. Mm. And I thought, here you are, it's in the family section of The Guardian, and she is saying, it's wonderful here and it's terrible here. Mm. But what she mentions somewhere in there, and there is, I think, a link there between her experience of being a mother, but you get a sense that somewhere something is quite antagonistic between her and the father. So my question is, where is the father in all this? You know, because it has to be there. You know, there is the third, in a sense. So, you know, it, like Medea, I mean, she does send the poison dress, doesn't she?
Yeah, she does, yeah.
So, you know.
Yeah, do you mean the father, her father?
Well, the husband, in a sense, the father of the children. I'm thinking we're talking not just about a mother, she carries them, so I think her experience.
And also, if not the father, where is society?
Yeah. Exactly.
Around.
Yeah. And the representative is.
Absolutely. And I mean, I'm thrilled that you came away from that production with that feeling, because that to me is success. That's what I wanted to poke at.
I think
and for me, I find it shocking that even my friends who are starting to have children, suffering from the most extreme postnatal depression, and in this day and age cannot discuss it. The sense of shame around that feeling, ambiguity about motherhood, despite their social standing or class or whatever. I don't think we're puncturing this question enough. I don't think we're challenging it. I don't think we're discussing it enough. And, you know, I think it's unhelpful to all of us, and to society. But I also think the attributing blame, which the Medea myth and pigeonholing this crime as an extension of revenge is unhelpful. In the same way, I think, and I know this is an extremely controversial thing to say in here, but I find clinical terminology extremely unhelpful, because we're just expelling people from our myths with those terms, and I don't think we're giving enough breadth and scope to the discussion on grassroots level.
But, for example, appears in the paper A woman left the children and went to Spain with money, whatever, and everybody goes against this woman. And I say, well, sorry, what about us? What are we doing there? We never gave space for this woman to say, at the end of everything, I'm going to kill myself, to kill everybody, if I don't just rush away from here. But it's the automatic response is one of blaming or seeing that person as a terrible person and never to question ourselves, what are we doing about this? Okay, the question about pathologizing, I find it difficult because I'm a psychiatrist. And so I think that, yeah, but I think that in a way, we have to do is to take away the stigma of the mental health problems. That's the problem. Is that we have stigmatized all these situations. I mean, I have had people who were coming to the consulting National Health Service to lie down on the couch and to say, what the fuck do you think you are doing with me? I have read in the papers that psychopathic personality cannot be cured by psychotherapy. People just, you know, they just read the papers, or, you know, borderline personality cannot be. You just don't know what to do about this because people are just seeing themselves as a sort of a way also to separate themselves from what they are, is to put themselves also as with the title there. It is very hard how we can combine our own efforts, our own resources, our own help to see situations that appear to be so abnormal as part of normality. That's a problem.
Can I say something about the father, the absent father, which I think is really, really interesting and a vital question. Where are the fathers? And again, when I wrote Magda, Joseph Goebbels appears at the end. He's told by his wife he can't enter the room where she just killed her children. Again, in my version, which might or might not be historically accurate because they're conflicting views, was he in the room with her killing the children? In my version, she's on her own. And that was vital because I wanted the father figure. It's not existent.
In her mind, father figure is really strong. All that stuff about the leader and him.
Yeah, no, but that's because she hasn't had a real father. You know, so Magda, I think, is desperate for a father figure because in some ways there is no father figure. And if you want to look at it historically, for example, in Germany, what I'm very aware of is, so you had in Germany a whole generation of people who were brought up by either no fathers because they died in the First World War, and of course other nations suffered a similar fate, but on top of it, the fathers who came back, or the men who came back from the war, you know, were psychologically hugely damaged and weren't given anyway a sort of safehold. And as a nation, of course, the Germans were stripped of their dignity. And what's interesting is, of course, that mistake wasn't made by the international community after the Second World War, and that's why I think there was a much better recovery. But you had a whole generation of, for example, women, but also men, but women, who grew up fatherless, no solid father figure around.
It's called the fatherland, which is very rare.
Which is another interesting
Germany
point.
Is called the fatherland. Yeah, I've never understood. I'd love to know why. What did it happen? And when did that happen?
When did that began to be called the fatherland?
I don't know.
it's
the absence of the father figure, which, of course, in Beside the Sea, you know, that there's no father for the children around. There's no.
Yeah,
the male.
Can I say something about that? Because I feel really strongly that in this conversation that we mustn't then fall into the trap of thinking that the father's the one that's going to come and save everything and keep a check on the mad mother, which psychoanalysis, by the way, is often complicit with. So this notion of the third, which is always the thing that's going to save this terrible, crazy dyad between mother and child, and therefore the third element associated with the paternal in psychoanalysis becomes idealized. Actually, it's the Agamemnons of this world that end up killing the kids. It's very rare, the mothers do. And so it's interesting that in a structure where you ask about the absent father and we think about these figures that don't have fathers and then think of that as a context, it feeds into a very pernicious thing where the paternal becomes the thing which beats back the madness of the mother. And that's a real
problem. I think your book is so beautiful because what...
In
Amber's book, actually, and this is why I'm literally walking around at the moment telling
you. She's so nice.
Buy this book. Fully expensive.
And I feel very privileged to have put you together.
Yes, exactly. No, but what Amber's actually saying in this book, which I just thought, yes, she is saying, I think I have a quote here. Basically, what you're saying is so if we look at matricide, if we look at all this myth, it's not in order to even undo it. We can't undo myth, but it's to actually acknowledge it and find a way of thinking about it in order to go on. And that woman, that's how I understood in particular, because you quote Erika, who's a leading feminist. And for me, she's a French feminist who I like very much, Luce Irigaray. But the problem I always had with her is that she sort of, she says all the great things and then says, and we're all sisters and we all love each other. And you think, no, why? You can't do that. We need to restructure our thinking.
But statistically, men who kill their children and do so as an extension of violence and rage and domestic violence, women tend to operate with this act of altruism, this skewered act of altruism that is in Beside the Sea. What does that say about our own view, our own position in the world and how we view, what it is to be a woman in the world, and what aren't we addressing prior to these horrific
female
aggression. It's not as altruism as opposed to aggression.
Well, is it?
Was skewered.
It's a fantasy in altruism.
Exactly.
Well,
almost masochism.
Yeah.
That's right. It's always against themselves.
It's rather than altruism. It's a kind of masochism.
Yes? No, sorry, we have to give some voices.
It's actually a question for you, Stella. We've spoken about how power is involved in killing your children. It's this kind of climax intoxication with power. Have any of the women that you've worked with also spoken about the euphoria that might follow that, or a sense of rebirth, or is it only repentance that they've spoken about?
There's a question. I think that they are different. And again, we have to go to different pathologies, I'm sorry, but for example, the mother that commits this, that is suffering from I always like to emphasize the term suffering. People are suffering, men or women are suffering. And people are feeling that, they have a fantastic life. No, people are suffering. The man suffers from aggression too. But, for example, the women who suffer from, by proxy, Munchausen syndrome by proxy, is very different from these other people. This Munchausen syndrome by proxy, the women, they feel completely detached. It's a coldness. When you said about that, it's a complete coldness of the experience. I had a woman who has the breast, quite displaying the breast, the names of the two children. And I said, I want them to come to the grave with me. Meantime, she had killed the children. No, she had not killed the children. She had persuaded the specialist, in skin specialist, that the children were suffering from fungi disorders, huh? From birth, she had the second baby, and exactly the same. I completely convinced the doctor about this. And that's the sense of power and triumph. But it's a very common one, too, in which, but it's a very, very different pathology, this one. I mean, and I have to say pathology, because it's a different world in which these women, they feel completely detached. And they may experience that degree of, that you talked about. For example, women who, those shoplifting, they experience a great sense of elation, even in their bodies too, about that. So, the body is very, very much to women, and the body that also is able to produce babies.
More general question.
Yes.
Do you think that there is Jason's new wife, and it's about saying the object that I have been
yes. by killing her.
Yeah.
So that's sort of like the male fear of the woman taking yeah. ownership over kind of her own role as mother.
Yeah, I think that's an intriguing interpretation because I often think of her as a sort of feminist terrorist in that she's killing his. She says a lot. I'm going to shatter and make Jason's house a shambles. Yeah. She wants to destroy his legacy and the legacy yeah. of patriarchy, which is the transmission of wealth and power between father and son. So by killing the two sons, and it's specifically sons.
Yeah.
And interestingly, if you look at other versions of the myth, there are daughters and other kids as well, but we take the fact that she killed her two sons, and so does Euripides, because Euripides is quite interested in this place of women. So I think that's absolutely right, that the fear of the monstrous mother is linked to ideas of the part of the genetic fantasy of the father wanting to take control and attack the mother's capacity to give birth and eradicate her from the symbolic legacy of transmission. And so Medea's fighting back and trying to, like I say, act as a female terrorist by subverting the patriarchal transmission.
And then she actually takes the children with her.
And survives, by the way. Amazingly, because normally these tragic figures come to a terrible end. So they have the euphoria and the catharsis of the victory, but then they're usually killed. Medea goes away in a chariot to Athens and survives, and Jason and his house and his legacy and his patriarchal inheritance is completely eradicated. It's an incredible play in that she gets that victory and that elation that we have as well. And that we identify with the aggressor because she is, but she's also a victim.
I'm going to this. I just want to. I think that I agree with you. No, it was just thinking. We are all capable of all the most criminal things. The fact is, some people do and some people don't. But when they say to me, "How is that you were working with rapists, with murderers, and all that? You were so small. Didn't you feel scared?" And I said, "Well, I feel that I could be very violent, and they feel that I could be very violent. I could kill someone too. And I know that. I think that people just are aware of this. Yeah. This is an immediate reflection. But some people have had the lack or whatever to be equipped with a better situation than others too. And they are able to, you see, the problem is the thought doesn't intervene there. If the thought is there, if people can think before they act, they could not do it.
I actually just found the answer to why I chose
Montgomery. Oh, right.
But of course, but again, I was conscious of this. What I also address there is, I think women have been let off the hook incredibly easily with history. The fact that 50% of mankind is female. However, we see history always, you know, as to the man's eyes. And what's fascinating is one of the reactions I often get from Magda is people say, "Oh, I can now sympathize with Magda." And I think I was empathizing with her as I was writing the book, but I never wanted to excuse her. What I was actually also fascinated or interested in is this is a woman who commits a horrendous crime. And history doesn't judge her. History doesn't judge the mothers. All the men and all the women, but also all the men have mothers. Now,
coming on a daily basis, we don't need to make monuments out of it.
Well, but we need to start, as you said earlier, we need to start to look at it and addressing it, you know, because
But the crime that she was complicit with, which is the Holocaust, is so far more, it's so unspeakable that the killing of the seven children in a way is like, oh well, she was a Nazi and she was complicit with... I'm trying to say that I have deep... What you made me do through your book, which was amazing, was come up against my own emotional and intellectual difficulty of identifying with Magda Goebbels. I was reading it thinking, I hate Magda Goebbels, I don't want to empathise with her. She was complicit.
But I was never asking the reader.
No, but it's written so beautifully that you do get inside and you're asked to do that. And then so when she kills her children, the enormity of the Holocaust is there as the shadow. And so in some senses it's a very, very weird position as a reader to be in because she's let off the hook maybe within history in relation to the kids, but is she let off the hook in relation to her complicity with the Holocaust?
No, she is. I mean, is she a Nazi woman?
Maybe
in general, have not been prosecuted. Nazi woman, a woman married to Nazis.
Right, really.
In fact, there's a whole one of my favourite stories, which I came across in my research. In 1947, the Allied forces suddenly realised, the Americans and the French suddenly realised, American and British suddenly said, oh my God, there are all these women married to leading Nazi men. They're running around loosely, you know. Let's gather them. They gathered them, those women, that was party time. They hadn't seen each other for 2 years. They lived in relative poverty. I mean, this is not me making up. There are some, amazing sources on this. They had drinks party, school reunion time. Men drink, and there's literally, the diary entries, letters from these women afterwards, because after 3 months, the Allied realised, well, there's very little we can do here. You know, we have nothing against them officially, and we're paying our money in order to entertain these women who haven't eaten that well for 2 years. So they opened the gates.
That would be a good film.
That would be a good one. Yeah.
No one has yet.
You better start writing this fast.
but and that's coming back to again this idea of yes. So they are women like Magda Goebbels in this immense, history, and they are not judged. Yeah. Women aren't judged. Mothers aren't judged. And I'm not saying we should now condemn all mothers and, beat ourselves up. We need to start realizing that as women and as mothers, we psychologically need to change.
I think the culture needs to change.
There was a question here.
I wanted to ask the recent case of the mother who took her son up last week.
She hasn't been proven guilty yet.
No, she's been charged.
Yeah, but she's not said she's guilty.
I don't know. I know is she's been charged.
Yeah, she's
but we don't know much about it. All I know is he was a twin, and she has apparently five children. There's no mention of a man.
Yes, it's a husband and also a biological father.
I think she's divorced.
Divorced, but there's a biological father of that child who she's not married with.
Okay. I mean, I was just wondering if you had any theories about her.
We were just talking about it actually before. There has been a spate since we began this 2 years ago. There have been an enormous amount of cases.
So many cases, yeah. Right, yeah.
Well, not in relation to men killing their children. There's not been an... I mean, that's the thing we must forget about.
What?
Children are in danger mainly from fathers, uncles, and Jimmy Savile types, not their mothers. But yes, there's a lot of spate cases, and it's crucial we look at them in order to look at the, all the things that you're saying. But, I mean...
Could it actually be a spate of reporting of the cases?
Reporting.
Yeah, maybe.
And a sensation. Everyone gets quite excited when a mother kills their children, don't they? Mm. When father kills children, it's just like, oh, he shot the whole family and himself. That's normally what you see on the BBC website. Oh, it's another one. A man that killed the whole family and himself. But when it's a woman killing her children, we all get so excited and have the euphoria you were talking about. But there's a cultural euphoria about this. And I don't understand that.
It's to do with that we don't accept it as part of ourselves.
So when it's out there, we kind of like get excited because it represents something
it's
that we regret.
It's sort of the horror thing. Mm. I mean, that's why we get excited. That's why she killed
her. Well, apparently. But women do really carry babies. Mm. And we might be thinking about the different kinds of experience that you have. The experience of being the father and the mother, you have a different, conception takes place inside the mother. I think psychologically it's a different, how do we think about the difference between the two? As you're saying, it becomes much more sensational. Well, this is because you gave birth to him.
Is that more shocking because of
her? Well, I'm just questioning that, you can't, it's about not saying that the experiences can possibly, in a sense, be the same.
Yeah.
It seems to me it's about female aggression.
It's the shop.
Well, that's right.
The shop of breast. But if women are having a fight, nobody wonders why. I mean, the women, they have fights. I mean, but they can be really. So it's just, it's to do with babies, is it, the situation. It's when you operate as a mother.
That is so. I suppose birth is very close to death in the experience. So when you're giving birth, even though it's so deeply about life, the proximity to danger and death and extremity is so intense that life and death can psychically, the fear of the baby dying as well inside you or when you're giving birth is a fantasy that maybe links to infanticide as well. Do you know what I mean? That the body as the site of the death of the child, which can happen purposefully or not purposefully. So that,
no, the mentioning of death and ending, we have few minutes left. So, you have any, yes, any question?
Well, it was about Lacan. He didn't have, Jacques Lacan, he didn't have anything to say about women killing children. I just wanted to ask, a good friend of mine said he was misogynistic. Do you think he was, Jacques Lacan?
You know, you are the one who knows best about this. You are the academic here.
You're not very friendly about him in your book, are you?
Don't
take a
hold. Oh, no, just say something. Just give
it. I think he did something very good for women on the one hand, in that he had an idea about femininity that isn't to do with essentialism or the body. So he allowed femininity to be something that we construct and we make up, which frees women from being chained to anatomy.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, he had a very misogynist strain because the symbolic that he theorized was always patriarchal, and he seems to think of it as static and universal. So on the one hand, he's been helpful for feminists by freeing us from biology as our destiny. On the other hand, he's been hampering feminism because of his attachment to the patriarchal structure as something that's unchangeable. So he's been both.
Okay, this is now the ending time, and I think we have to very much to be very grateful to our panel members who have been so open and so really sincere in having their own differences displayed and openly discussed. Thank you.